This is side two of broadcast number 657, July 9th, 1984. It's Mae Brussel, KAZU FM, Pacific Grove, California. There's a story in the New York Times: Hunter's killing of three cougars in federal experiment angers environmentalists. The important point wasn't that the federal government was just happening to kill these animals and their cubs, but that they had radio collars on them and that they would wear the collars and it would give them radio receiver information, and then they would shoot them down. And the purpose, they said, was for behavioral study. Now, we know how these animals act and move, and I'm sure that the shooting of these animals wearing these collars could be applied to human beings later on how to find them, not how they respond in the forest. We know how they act in a forest. The behavioral study of the animals has probably been done enough, but they were wearing these electronic collars. Now, just last October, I mentioned, I don't know if I had this on the air or not, but I might have mentioned that the L.A. Prepare the Police for Future Technology in Fighting Crime. And if I did have it before, I'll remind you, but this is one of the stories that I meant to have on if I hadn't done already. This has to do with the Los Angeles Police Department having a conference to update their Forum 2000 that they had 10 years ago. And they described certain non-lethal weapons they'll use to round up people with satellite photos of the city to chase the suspect. When the crook is caught, he'll be identified with a 3D holograph mugshot and sentenced either to an island penal colony or the deep freeze. Upon release or thawing, the authorities will keep track of the parolee through a tiny radio transmitter beneath the skin. This was brought up 10 years ago at the Forum 2000 by the Los Angeles Police Department to hedge against the future shock and application of these. Now, I have information and articles of that meeting 10 years ago and even before that. And at that time, 25 million transponders had been manufactured to insert under the skin, just as Mr. Pettit is talking about, to put into these people to control if they leave their neighborhood, if they have sexual desires, if they go more than five blocks out of what would be, say, a ghetto area. It tells them to go back. It gives them instructions. They can be ready, radio computerized, and 25 million were manufactured over 10 years ago. And just this October 83, the L.A. Deputy Chief Clyde Cronkite is sitting at the kind of computers that will be in automobiles. They're already putting them into 800 patrol cars now, and they'll put more. So the minute they get a name, they can computerize the entire file, whether you're going too slow or fast or had a drink or accident or whatever. They can put exactly who you are and every single thing about you. I'm sure these are the Bobby Inman Western Goals computers that are fed with you. And then you go to a penal colony or deep freeze, and then a transponder is put into your head. So if it sounds like 1984, these were made in 1974 and 72, but the application comes up again in the trial or the appeal of Mr. Petit, of what they did to him, and it is indeed possible. They did see objects in his body and refused to take them out. Now, last week I talked about poor Mr. Thornwall, the fellow that got the LSD, not when we were in war, but in 1961 over in France, where he was tortured and investigated. This is the fellow that died in 8 feet of water last week, and he won that controversial settlement from the CIA because he could prove, after the exposés came out about the CIA drug control, that he was a victim of their testing program. And James Thornwell, as I say, dies at a time where people could really have him lecturing around the country or explaining what happened to him. But the San Jose Mercury had another story about his death. Sad life ends for man given LSD by Army. And not only did they torture him and keep him for 2 months without food or toilet in a single room and simulated a gunfight and made him think he'd been kidnapped, but at the time of the incident, the Army was involved in clandestine operation in which a special purpose team roamed the world, the entire world, experimenting with this drug on foreign nationals, many of them Southwest Asians. Well, many of them were Asians, but many of them were in the United States. They used this here. They didn't just use it in Europe. And I'm sure that places like the Army Hospital in San Antonio are capable of doing this kind of thing. The Army roamed the world with special purpose teams in giving this, and then these victims would fall down, lose their jobs, lose their wives, became totally useless, and many suicidals, and that so that when you see a controversial person at the height of an investigation jumping out of a window, like Dr. Frank Olson, who was given the same LSD, a normal man with a normal family who they tested on, they didn't make the test for Mr. Thornwell or Mr. Olson. They made it for the whole world, and when he says that there is a project through the whole world to control the world, it is being disseminated around the world. Now, back to the Vicky Morgan case. The case is closed. Mr. Pankos has been found guilty. But in the newspapers last week, there were articles about that mentioned in her defense, in the defense of Mr. Pankos, that he could be telephonically controlled through hypnosis. This finally came out in the newspapers. This is a technique that's been used. And this, the Los Angeles Herald had a story that the lawyer, Mr. Barron, said for Marvin Pankos that they suggested, and also Mr. Matthews, the defense attorney, Arthur Matthews, working with Mr. Barron, suggested Pankos was hypnotized by writer Gordon Basishis, who was working at Morgan's autobiography at the time of her death, into confessing he killed Morgan. It's quite possible. He called up, and I suggest that Gordon Basishis called the house, woke Marvin up, and said, "Marvin, you killed Vicky. It's your fault. You did it. You're responsible." He was interested in telephonic hypnosis theory, and they referred to that at the trial, the telephonic hypnosis theory, credited for making him go down and confess when there was no physical evidence or any part of his actually having killed Vicky Morgan. So this is Mr. Basishis was a student of hypnosis. Now, remember the telephone that Dan White got, and he was staying home the morning. He went to kill George Moscone, the mayor of San Francisco, and supervisor Harvey Milk. He gets a telephone call. He puts the gun in his pocket. He's picked up by a secretary, climbs through a window because he's smart enough to know the gun will be detected, and shoots those two people. George de Morenschild, primary witness to the murder of John Kennedy, was meeting with the House Assassination Committee in the afternoon, and he is in the morning with Edward Epstein, who's worked closely with the Central Intelligence Agency and the inner team of disinformation on the assassination. Jean de Morenschild said that she disputed her husband's suicide. She said at the time that he died, her husband was working with a high intelligence agent in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, that he was close with him. She said de Morenschild worked with intelligence as far as World War II, back when he served as a German agent in the United States, that he was a petroleum engineer working and closely associated with people like H.L. Hunt and Oklahoma's Bob Kerr, that his closest friends at the time of the assassination, one of them was a CIA man and a Fort Worth man connected with military, a security organization, and that Lee Harvey Oswald was possibly an agent of the United States. She believed that. And also she said her husband's troubles began when he received an injection from a doctor who practiced in Dallas, and shortly after that he had a nervous breakdown. Then he was taken to Holland and then to Florida, and when they're about to open up the investigation, and I consider the number one witness, he picks up the phone, then hangs up, reaches in a drawer, and shoots the gun in his mouth, and he's dead. So the telephonic hypnosis comes into there in the interest of Basici in hypnosis. Now, David Ferry, another primary witness, the Kennedy assassination, who Jim Garrison wanted when he arrested Clay Shaw, all of a sudden dies of karate at the back of his head, but he was a student of hypnosis. Candy Jones wrote her book about the CIA and how she was telephoned, hypnotically told through the telephone on the different things she should do, including going down to Bermuda and committing suicide, and her husband saved her. But every one of these hypnosis things has to do with assassinations in the CIA, and she began her hypnotic treatments with injections in Oakland. She was flown from New York to Oakland. So injections, whether it's de Morenschild or Candy Jones or hypnosis with David Ferry or Dan White, the subject came up. Of course, it was quickly closed in the case of the Pankos trial. Also, there is another story in the LA Herald. Pankos defense can't introduce high government officials involved. The motive for hypnotizing Pankos, the motive for killing her, the sex parties the month before she's dead, the people high up in the kitchen cabinet in Reagan's administration is enough motive to want to wipe out this person. And the prosecution and the judge evidently had an agreement right from the start that nothing could be introduced about government officials. Once again, Pankos becomes the Lee Harvey Oswald of the Reagan administration taking the brunt for silencing somebody because of the blackmail purposes that Vicky could have used for the government. And because he had a history of mental illness and being in mental hospitals, he's a perfect candidate for that. They also said at the trial, it was in the San Francisco Chronicle, that he had a proclivity for confessing to murders he didn't do. Pankos had a record of mental problems. The defense attorney said he habitually confessed to crimes he never committed. One of them included was the Manson family. Now, the confessions that Mr. Pettit was afraid that they were going to use him for when they put those little bottles and transmitters into his body that the CIA won't remove from that at that hospital, his fear was that he would be used for assassinations. With Jim Jones, the purpose of the mind control was to get, and he has an outer entourage of over 120 people that are out loose now who murdered those people and put the blankets over them, either poisoned them or shot them in the back, covered them up, and those assassins are out loose to murder for the United States government right now. But any murders they did, if Jonestown were still going, the confessions could be signed by these poor people that were down in Jonestown. So what you have is the problem of hypnosis, of injections, of conspiracies, of confessions to things that you didn't do, coming up at the Vicky Morgan trial and having precedence in other cases around the world. Now, another story of medical experiments that I want to update or go into was brought in the news again this week. The Navy considered closing a lab, but a new mission was found. This is the laboratory in Oakland, California, where they opened it in 1950. This is when the CIA really got heavy into their medical experiments and took over the medical field, the cancer as well as the medical field. They put an office in Oakland where they made lethal medicines piped into rotating drums. Organisms were blended with lethal mist. And they tested it first on animals and then on humans. And they made, for germ warfare, diseases like plague, tularemia, and others. They don't tell you what the others were. But one case, there was a lawsuit where a gentleman died from pneumonia, and the family said it came from the spraying over San Francisco. They took a Navy ship out. Now, they didn't do all this for a ship. This is a multi-million dollar lab that went on for 20 years. But one of the things they did, they also did them in tunnels. They took a ship out, and they had these organisms sprayed that were known to be dangerous to elderly and debilitated people. And unknown to the public, the experiment caused at least one death. Now, the LSD and the examination of the drugs, the church committee, with Mr. Olson going out the window, he went out the window. That's one window case. It's like all of World War II was started by one man, Hitler. All of Watergate is one man, Nixon. These things are so big, but they zoom it into simplistic terms that people can relate to. They say at least one death and other tests. So they made this mist that debilitates people, and they still continue, even though this lab was stopped and it's opening up again. They now continue germ weaponry at Fort Detrick, Maryland, right now, devising ways to work with biological agents. Now, the important thing about this is that these people not only kept it, this office was never closed, but the excuse that the lab will open up now is to treat diseases rather than cause them, and they actually were causing them. And now they have new projects going. It said, along with their projects now, they continue work on slow viruses, mysterious organisms, infecting animals and humans that lie dormant for many years before progressively and relentlessly destroying the brain and nervous system. Now, I've been very suspicious of the Alzheimer's disease. The way it grew, I heard a whole hour broadcast last week that it's going to be the epidemic of the next era. And what are we going to do with these old people? They don't have no memory. They can't remember their families. And the tragedy, their lives are completely gone. You're talking to strangers, and they reduce themselves just to vegetables, literally. And so now they're talking about studying and destroying brain and nerve tissue. But if you spread those germs on these drums, say, throughout the country, it would be interesting to know if other countries like France and Germany and Italy and Asia, China and Japan have Alzheimer's, too, because you know, these mass murders are symptom of the United States. These mass diseases, France now is working on the AIDS virus, but that is spreading, of course, but it emanates in the United States. The Alzheimer's came from a German who took his name on, maybe there were one or two cases, but years ago, the bubonic plague was stopped. And now we manufacture bubonic plague. When measles was stopped, we still manufacture the measles or the polio. And the point is that the tularemia and the other diseases, if you manufacture them and administer them, you're going to see them resurge again. And the thing is that maybe the spring from 1950 to 1970 is now showing up in the 80s, so that the 1980s and 1990s will have a mass of Alzheimer's disease that are the consequence of what they did, and now they can study it. It's good for medicine, it's good for the doctors, it's good for the rest homes, but then it leads to something else. The next logical step from Alzheimer is the German system of extermination, because they're useless. And that fits into a point which I'll bring up in about 1 minute if we have time, otherwise next week. So the story of the spring and using the lab again and opening up, and what they did before and what they're doing now, makes me very suspicious. Now, I have studied these different diseases and the way they surfaced as they came, being suspicious at the beginning. The Legionnaires, which was the middle-class white people, the swine flu that came along, and the mass testing of injecting people around the country, and the paralysis that followed afterwards, the Tay-Sachs, which has been singled out for the Jews, the AIDS for the homosexuals, the sickle cell for the blacks, and the progeria for young, and I believe, and I keep promising, and I'll do it, a program on the space programs and progeria. I think these are experiments on the women, either when they are actually pregnant or as soon as the child is born, in shrinking people to small bodies applicable to space stations, which is written up in the literature of space stations, and the goal of those poor people with the grown-up heads but the little tiny bodies. And I think there's something for everybody, the black, the Jew, the middle class, and the elderly, and the gays. And this is an original thought, because years ago the CIA was devising some kind of concoctions to separate the ingredients in milk that would be symptomatic to individual people that would be fatal to their colors, whether it's red or yellow or Caucasian, you know, and blacks, that they were already experimenting on how to target specific races for genocide through chemicals. So this study on the Pacific Coast and the drums and the chemicals, and then carrying it to a national level, just like the world distribution of the LSD in the 60s and 70s for testing or neutralizing whole groups of people. Now, but I wanted to update the medical implications and the mind control implications of the Tylenol case, and I haven't done much on that program for a long time. I did quite a bit when it first surfaced. Sunday, July 1st, San Jose Mercury has, FBI is pushing the Tylenol extortionist to confess to 7 cyanide murders. Now, they've got James Lewis, who wrote the extortion note, and he's been found guilty of writing that note telling Johnson & Johnson that I will give me so much money and I'll stop putting cyanide in. He wanted to make a few million off of it. Now, the psychiatrist, again, so important in Nazi Germany, the psychiatrist made out a psychological profile of Lewis, and on the advice of the psychiatrist, they wrote to the FBI and said, Lewis may confess out of a need to be seen as a genius who committed the perfect crime by killing 7 people. The psychiatrist advised the FBI to apply psychological pressure on Lewis and play on his ego in an attempt to obtain a confession of incriminating evidence. His analysis is thought to be a prime reason to consider him a suspect. Then they admitted that there is no physical evidence, no direct evidence linking Lewis to the cyanide killing, and Lewis is afraid that they will administer mind-altering drugs to him to get a government prosecution. He said that he's been arrested, and he's been guilty of another murder that he never served time for, dismembering a friend. So he's a perfect candidate. Having done another crime, he's out on a leash, and they're trying to use a analysis by Dr. James Kavanaugh, chief of the Isaac Ray Center for Disordered Offenders at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center in Chicago. He has the kind of personality, so the FBI, if they could get a confession, make it on the basis that it would be good for his ego to prove how far he could go. Now, this last January, there was a story about another man who I suspect is the Tylenol killer, the actual killer. The story says, Tylenol case figured guilty. He's not guilty in the Tylenol. That was Roger Arnold, who had a one-way ticket to Thailand that I tied in at the time to the DeLorean case and the trip of William French Smith to Thailand real fast, the Thailand drug connection, and the Continental Bank of Illinois Roger Arnold was questioned in 1982 on the Tylenol cyanide poisoning death of 7 people. He was questioned. They went to his apartment. He had the cyanide. He had a book on how to do it. The police went into the apartment, found cyanide, and they released him and didn't charge him for anything. They charged the fellow who wrote the extortion note. But Roger Arnold killed a man just this last January. He accused the man of fingering him as being the one who killed the 7 people. And he killed the man who he said was an informant, John Stanisha, S-T-A-N-I-S-H-A, 46. It turned out that it was a mistaken identity, that the man he killed wasn't Stanisha. He's been found guilty of killing the man who he thought was the man who informed that he was the cyanide killer. And this is what I say about the Sinfuel investigation or the HUD. The person involved in the investigation or somebody that knows something is killed. He was charged with killing the person that he thought informed that he did it, but the police know he had the cyanide and had access to all those bottles also, and that so that what they're trying to do is to push the conviction onto Lewis when the other guy has the capability of gunning down a person he thinks informed on him. If he was innocent, you wouldn't have to kill an informer because the police had already cleared him. But now the FBI and the psychologists are trying to force, just like they do with Marvin Pancos, that confession. So that's an important thing to remember. And the pattern keeps reappearing over and over in these cases. Now, Adolf Hitler had an edict in going back early before 1941 on killing the aged. And I'm rereading and reading George Seldes' books. In fact, a friend, good loyal friend from World Watchers, bought me those 2 volumes of all of his issues. And I should be using them every week on the air because Seldes is a giant. And I talk about what we did a year ago, but this is what he did 40 years ago. He had a story. In fact, Hitler edict kills off 85,000 aged. Confirmation for the rumor that under the Hitler edict, the Nazis are killing thousands of agents, infirmed, mentally and physically unfit, was published in the New Republic May 5th, 1941. The discovery of the mass murders was made by Michael Strait, who got the tip from reading the Vatican newspaper, The Holy See. The priests in Germany found that hospital patients they visited were being injected with poison and air bubbles and asphyxiated in gas chambers. They wrote to the Vatican and questioned whether it was moral to put mentally and physically unfit to death, and the official publication of the Vatican took cognizance of the German murders. The Vatican has always opposed mercy killings. Following the tip, Strait says the Vatican sources confirmed that so far 85,000 deaths took place in German institutions on Hitler's orders. They were killed because they could no longer manufacture guns in return for their food, which they consumed, because the hospitals were needed for wounded soldiers, because the death was the ultimate logic of the National Socialist doctrine of racial superiority and the survival of the physically fit. Now, physically fit is an important word for what is happening now combined with the Alzheimer's disease. I am very suspicious of very fatty things such as having certain clothes to go to gyms, certain $30 and $40 and $50 outfits, certain kinds of shoes to run, people that run 6, 10, 12 miles a day, whose mind is separated totally from the world, but spend their time getting their high or their energy or their fix through that oxygen or whatever. Now, I'm not a physical fit nut, if you know me, know that, and I really don't go into that kind of thing, but I think there's an excess. I think that walking, every panel I've heard on hearts or Dr. Pritikin, and there's a panel of 5 experts on exercise on TV and hearts and the Stanford studies and so forth, walking slow or fast will do anything your body needs, and you can do that up into the hundreds. And when you get consumed with this body fitness and the image of the fit and the blonde, blue-eyed fit and the male macho American fit, when you get into that, you get into the ideal of what Hitler wanted. And when you get the infirm, when you get enough Alzheimer's, you get rid of the old people. Now, Ronald Reagan told the young people this week in a speech that even though you have jobs and you put into Social Security or Medicare, it may not be there when you get older. Now, Medicare has to make an important decision. When you're physically unable to live, when you get cancer at a certain age, are you supposed to, if you have no money, put $30,000 or $40,000, the working people, into tax or debt to maintain that person? if I knew that somebody had Alzheimer's and was just literally a vegetable, I don't know if I would want my taxes increased to support somebody who has no chance of recovery. But the question is, was the Alzheimer administered to them for the purpose of get rid of them because they're no longer useful or beautiful? Remember the play that I love so much, the Stephen Sondheim song, The Pacific Overture. And the song that Sondheim says is his favorite song, The Treaty House. And the theme of the song and the play is an old, old man who remembers as a little boy standing up in a tree and another under the floor when the meeting of Commodore Perry with the Japanese was made official, how Japan would modernize, and under the gunpowder at their neck, they had the choice of modernizing or being blown up, of selling out the values of ancient Japan and the Japanese families for the sake of modernization and corporations. And what you have today are Japanese factories that are similar to Germany. You take one job and you have it your whole life. You don't change your switch. You just stay in it your entire life. Now, the importance of that is that aged people have memories. If I could live to be 90, like my parents who are 90 and 94, I will continue to tell my children and grandchildren or whoever I see about what happened to John Kennedy, what happened to America, who Henry Kissinger was. Old people have memories, and they pass on traditions. That's the way the Bible was passed on, the legends, the Psalms of David, from families with aged memories. But you wipe out the memory, you wipe out the history. So you create the physically fit at one level who don't have time to sit and talk with older people. And at the other end, you disseminate the cancer and disease to the elderly or the controversial, the Martha Mitchells, the Jack Rubies, the people, the Senator Churches, you name it, Hubert Humphreys, all these political people, or the Adlai Stevenson, the drop dead from poison at lunch. When you get rid of them with diseases, you are making a political statement because you're wiping out your history. You're developing the youthful, or the only thing valuable is the person who's physically fit. Now, Hitler figured that out in 1941 and the Vatican repeated it, and it's current today, 40 years later, and thanks to George Seldes, it's a part of our history. And his brilliant mind is still alive, and it's wonderful that we have those things to make comparisons with then and now, because those people who were doing that then moved in with young Private Henry Kissinger from Germany and John J. McCloy and the various banking families that brought them to this country, the Fritz Kramers, the Peter Druckers that took over the multinational corporation. They have this on a conveyor belt, and the plan is working. And you have to be vigilant about these trials, the hypnosis, the injections, the radio control, the police plans for the injections and control. That is the real world. That is the way the world is running and is managed. And it's very important to follow these articles and trials every time the subject comes up. Well, that is enough to understand and comprehend for 1 week. I'll be back with you again next week. It's Mae Brussel at KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.